Today, as we continue on, we're looking at the early part of the story of Moses. We're picking up following the very earliest part, which is the part we all remember from our children's Sunday school lessons about Moses and the bulrushes in the basket, his growing up in the house of Pharaoh, and his eventual killing of an Egyptian guard who was abusing a Jewish slave. Because of that, we know that he had to flee. And so he ended up going out into the area of Midian, where he married his wife, and Jethro becomes his father-in-law. I think the thing that's probably hardest about this passage for us to really understand is the idea that it's very hard to know how much the Jews that are in captivity in Egypt at this point really know of their religious heritage. Okay? You know, we think of God talking to Adam and Eve, and we think of God talking to Moses, and we think of God talking to Abraham, and God appearing in things like we talked about last week to Jacob. We think of these things, and we think of there being this very personal, tight connection between the people of Israel and their God. However, we have to realize at this point, when they have moved into Egypt because of the famine, and they have now lived in Egypt for perhaps 200-300 years, it seems pretty clear at this point that they have really kind of lost sight of that relationship that they as a people had with Yahweh, with God. In fact, as we look here, Moses is now living in the desert. He is with the flocks of his father-in-law, Jethro, who is a priest of Midian, religious but not Jewish. Okay? And probably many of the Jews that are in Egypt at this time are religious, but we would not necessarily call them Jewish. It seems like at this point they have, to a large extent, adopted the religion of Egypt and the gods of Egypt. We can see this to a certain extent later on when they're wandering in the desert and they begin to lose faith. They want to have an idol constructed for them. They want to go back to the gods that they grew up with. And understanding that kind of makes it interesting. Moses is out tending the flocks when he sees the burning bush that is not consumed. And he goes over to look at it, to see it closer. And the voice comes to him and says, "Okay, stop, take off your sandals, you're on holy ground." And notice the first thing God says to him after he gives him those instructions. He says, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." God introduces himself. He reintroduces himself to the people of Israel and to Moses. Moses undoubtedly would have known about Abraham. I'm sure they told a lot of stories about Abraham. I'm sure they told a lot of stories about Jacob and about Isaac, the progenitors who came before they entered into Egypt. But it seems like perhaps they had lost sight of who was their God. And so God identifies himself as, "I am the God of your forebears," which means by extension, I am your God. "And I have heard the cry of my people," the Israelites, the descendants of Israel, the descendants of Jacob. "I have heard their cries coming up to me and their misery in Egypt. So I have now decided that I am going to send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." Moses begins by saying, "Well, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? You know, who am I to do this? Why are you choosing me?" And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But first, I want to go down to verse 13, which is kind of the challenge Moses is facing on a very practical level. because the Israelites have been in Egypt so long and they have come to adopt so many Egyptian gods, Moses is kind of saying to them, okay, suppose I go to the Israelites, I go to Egypt, I do what you want me to do, and I say, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? Think about that. Moses is sitting here going, I need a name. You know, if I go to Egypt and talk about Ra or Horus or Baal, they'll all know what I'm talking about. But who are you? What name am I supposed to give to these people to follow? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And this is what you're saying to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. It's interesting that in the Old Testament, we have to realize God doesn't really have a name. All the names that we give to him, Elohim, Yahweh, Jehovah, all of these are acronyms. All of them are names that are substituting for the unknown name of God. And it's kind of interesting because you kind of go, well, why doesn't God just give them a straightforward name? Well, part of it goes to kind of the way people thought at that point. God, names had power. But I think it's more the idea, I think, of God, particularly the one true God, that he didn't want to get put into a particular label. He didn't want to get boxed in, because that's what we tend to do when we give things names. We start identifying them as being a particular thing or a particular way. And it goes beyond just the names we have. You know, I'm Doug Pierce, Amy Wilde, Bob Wilde. It goes beyond those names. But I was thinking about this week as I was teaching in my interpersonal class, and we were talking about the labels we put on people. What does it mean as soon as we decide somebody's stupid or somebody's mean? You know, the label carries baggage with it. A name carries baggage with it. I was talking with my students about even having their family name. It was always a challenge, because what if you were the youngest kid in the family? Particularly in the old days, maybe you had 8 brothers and sisters. What was it like when you went to school and they went, oh, you're one of those Petersons? Okay. You get called your sister's name, one of those Sorensons. Okay. Names carry, meaning they carry value with them. We have presuppositions about particular names. And I think to a certain extent what God is saying here is, I'm not going to put myself in the box of your language. I'm not going to give you a name that is going to identify me and lock me into a particular place, a particular time, a particular set of attributes. I am not one thing, I am all things. I am. I exist. I am real, and I am the foundation of all there is. But it's interesting to me in this passage that one of the real keys to this passage is the idea of God reintroducing himself to the people of Israel, and the people of Israel being reintroduced to God. And that's what makes sense of, you know, why does God send the burning bush? He needs Moses to know he's God. He needs to do a miracle so that Moses knows this voice is a voice of power. And so God comes and shows himself in this way to Moses. He introduces himself to Moses. And he calls upon Moses to go and travel to Egypt to help out his people. But there's a challenge in all of this. First of all, in verse 11, as I already said, Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" He's saying, to a certain extent, there must be someone better. There must be somebody who could do this job more than I am. I'm an outcast. I have somebody who had to flee Egypt because I killed somebody. I'm out here. I'm married. I got my flocks. I live with Jethro. My life's pretty good. Who am I to send me? It gets even more agonizing when we get to chapter 4, starting in verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, "O Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue." This is kind of interesting because a period of time has passed. And Moses is going, "Well, you know, I talked to you at the burning bush a while back, and you know what? I haven't gotten any more eloquent. You haven't given me any magic powers here. How do you expect me to go and speak for you in front of the Pharaoh and to the people of Israel? I'm not eloquent, I haven't been eloquent, and I'm not eloquent now. I'm slow of speech and tongue." And the Lord says to him, "Who gave man his mouth? Who gave him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say." So God says to him, "You know, I will be with you. I will watch over you." Yet this is still not enough for Moses. Remember, Moses is really good at arguing with God. He argues with God numerous times in the Old Testament. And in this particular case, he says, "Oh, Lord, please send somebody else to do it. You know, please send somebody else." So even after God's reassured him and said, "Well, I'm going to give you the words, I'm going to do all of this," Moses is still going, "Can you please send somebody else?" Then in verse 14, "Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, 'What about your brother, Aaron? I know he can speak well. He's already on his way to meet you, and his heart will be glad when he sees you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak, and you will teach what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him.'" So God does actually kind of give him an out. He gives him Aaron, and Aaron's going to be Moses' kind of mouthpiece, the one who speaks for Moses in the midst of all of this. And it seems interesting that God had already, to a certain extent, lined this up. He says, "Aaron is already on the way to meet you." He's already given Moses support to help him in this mission that God is sending him on. What I think is interesting about this, and I probably had missed it when I first looked at why the narrative lectionary set things up the way it did, is we're actually looking at a series of calls here. And there's always something surprising about each of these series of calls we're looking at. Remember last week we looked at the call of Jacob. And it was kind of interesting because we know one of the interesting things about Jacob was that he was kind of the trickster. And as I talked about Jacob last week, we kind of were talking about the fact that God has the ability to use imperfect people. And in this case, we're talking about people with perhaps even imperfect morals, who don't live a perfect life for God. And yet God calls and uses Jacob for his purposes. Now we come to Moses. And God calls Moses to his purposes. And Moses doesn't seem to be worried about, you know, his background, his past, or any of that. Moses is basically just saying, "I don't have the skills to do what you want me to do." And this actually becomes a fairly common theme when we get to the prophets. There's a fair amount of prophets who go to God and say, "There has to be somebody better than me." And as I think about it, I think this deals really with the second aspect of any of us receiving a call from God. I think our first response when God calls us is quite often, "I'm not good enough." Because we're all well aware of the flaws we have and the errors we've made and the mistakes we've done. And so we're kind of going, "Well, I'm kind of there with Jacob I'm not a good enough person. You should find somebody more holy and righteous than me to go and serve you. But the second thing I think we often say is, even if I'm good enough to serve you, do I have the skills and the abilities to serve you? We always think, well, there must be somebody smarter than me. There must be somebody more articulate than me. There must be somebody stronger than me. Because again, we're all very aware of our own limitations. We know what our failings are in this world in terms of our communication and our interaction with other people. And so we always have this presumption that God can do better than me. But yet, God uses morally imperfect people. God uses people who speak slowly and are not articulate. He uses people who are not handsome. He uses people who are not strong. Even the Apostle Paul in the New Testament talks about how he is not really the best. He's not, you know, he's the least. You know, how can God use the least? Why not call the strong? Why not call the beautiful? Why not call the most articulate? Why not call the most intelligent? But the fact of the matter is, God can use everyone. And God has, in fact, a purpose for everyone in whatever way it may come. And ultimately, what God burns against is, I think, our effort to avoid service. When God has called us to do something, how often do we look for a reason to not do it, to avoid it? And we make our excuses to God. I'm not good enough. I'm not articulate enough. I'm not strong enough. I'm not fast enough. But the mistake we make is always thinking that our ability to do things in this world is limited to ourselves. We forget the power of the one who is calling us to service, that God is calling us to service. And if he is calling us to service, he will empower us to serve him. He will give us the strength, the support. Maybe he'll give us our Aaron who can speak for us. Maybe he'll give us the strong back who will come beside us and give us the strength we don't have. Maybe he'll give someone with stamina to help when my stamina falls short. But the fact of the matter is, if God has called us to it, then God will provide. Now, being a cautious, somewhat conservative person, I will once again go back to something I talk about always when I'm talking about call, which is there does need to be discernment. Okay? God is probably most often going to use you in ways that fit with your skills, abilities, and so forth. And if suddenly you're feeling, wow, I'm supposed to go do this crazy thing I've never done before, maybe take a moment and sit down and talk with people and see if it makes sense. I think I really learned this. One of the missionaries from Japan a few years ago, 10, 12 years ago, was speaking at Dassel Covenant, and I was there, and it was kind of interesting. He grew up as the children of missionary, and not surprisingly, a lot of children of missionaries become missionaries. And so he said, you know, when I was going to college and going to seminary, I felt the call to the mission field. And of course, if you're going to be a missionary, the question is, where should you go? Should I go to Mexico? Should I go to Africa? Should I go to Japan? Should I go to China? And he said, you know what? I grew up as parents of kids of missionaries in Japan. I grew up speaking Japanese. Where's the most sensible place for God to use me in the world? Well, it's probably Japan. Okay, you know, most likely God is going to use us with the gifts, skills, abilities that he has given to us. I'm not saying that's always the case, but most often it probably is. And it's part of our act of discernment to try and determine how best we may serve God. And is the belief we have a call from him accurate? And we turn that over to the community to help us discern those things. Because we do know that sometimes people try and do things they don't have the skills for, and it often doesn't work. We have to make sure and be cautious that the voice we're hearing is the voice of God. Because very few of us get, like Moses, a burning bush. Very few of us get visions like Jacob got. Most of us are having to listen to quiet voices that we must make sure and discern are, in fact, the word of God. But of course, we know God used Moses. He used him to do great things and to bring his people out of captivity. If God can use Moses to do great things, he can use us to do great things. And when he calls us, I pray that we would have the confidence to accept his call and to seek to do his will to the best of the gifts and the abilities that we have. Thanks be to God.